Welcome to Raised on D&D Podcast. Raised on D&D brings you inspirational interviews with tips and strategies to enrich your family's gaming experience. Your host for Raised on D&D has been a dungeon master for over 30 years and a father to three gamers. Here is Nick Carrarelli.
Welcome back, gamers. I'm your host, Nick Carterelli, and this is Raised on D&D. My next guest is originally from Princeton, Illinois, and currently resides in Wisconsin. You know him from his published material in Iron Crown Enterprises' Rolemaster and his cartography work from Kingdoms of Kalimar. His new ice-themed 5e setting, Dalryth Haven in the Ice, is currently on Kickstarter. Please welcome Darren Anderson. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for being on the show. We're super excited to have you on. We're watching the Kickstarter and can't wait to see how it all finishes up. But before we get into all that, Darren, can you take us back and tell us a little bit about how you started playing Dungeons & Dragons and playing tabletop role-playing games?
Sure. So this was, I was a product of the 80s, early 80s, when D&D was, just starting to hit the wave, right, in the 1980, 1979 timeframe. I was a preteen at the time, and the Blue Box set showed up with one of my friends, and we opened it up and were fascinated with the polyhedral dice that were in there. They weren't inked or anything, if I recall correctly. We had to use crayons and figure out what color to put on the sides of the dice, and opened it up and started playing D&D at that setting, and loved some of the basic D&D pieces. And we had a bookstore in town that we persuaded to bring in some of the modules. So I picked up all those early 80 first edition modules, and then second edition as it came out. So we had a summer school program for math, for all the math experts and math students. They were a little bit ahead of their grade level, and we pulled the D&D book out because we were bored with learning more about math, and it was summertime. And so we ended up really getting deep into D&D, and I went to Gen Con that year and picked up Rolemaster, which was called Arms Law at the time. And so then integrated some of the Arms Law, which it came out as components early on, which had a bunch of neat critical hits and had chart after chart after chart with, of course, math geeks at the time really loved that kind of stuff. And so it just really evolved from there. So, you know, really I started back in early on, played some D&D, and then transitioned more into Rolemaster, feeling that it was quite a bit of a different system. And I don't know if you call it more real. I don't think any of them are real, but it was a bit more challenging to learn and had a lot more impacts. Putting an arrow through the eye of a beholder, right, with a critical hit is kind of fun type of thing. So
a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with Rolemaster. What was it that really drew you to it, besides all the amazing charts?
Well, I think what I liked about it is they have the way they did magic was with spell points. And so it wasn't the learned knightly spell point type activity, almost like what they've done with Sorcerer in the last few years, where the Sorcerer can kind of pull and cast any spell. That gave a lot more ability to do stuff than a first level mage who, after you cast your magic missile and throw your one dart, then you have to use a staff to do anything. Some of the weaknesses of first edition, which we all loved, were just generally first level you can't do much, or second level as a magic user. So the Rolemaster kind of gave you, even at first level, you could do all sorts of things beyond that, and then use your spells in different level, different areas. So it was more of the flexibility that we liked from it. A lot of the components you've seen come into D&D since then. So without the crazy charts, they've taken some of the good elements. The initiative system is in a way sort of here, and a few other pieces too.
It's fantastic. Now, Darren, fast forwarding, you're a husband and a father now. And how old is your son?
Jack is 12 years old.
So tell us a little bit about Jack. Has he always been interested in role-playing games?
Yeah, he started, we started playing the Red Box when he was probably 5, maybe. And he had an incredible adventure. If you remember the old Red Box setting, they have a room with, there's some skeletons at a table, and there's a fireplace, and there's actually encounter, I believe, Harpy inside the fireplace.
Yes.
And so he was playing four characters because, you know, we were just playing him and myself, and he's just running all four of them. And without even a heartbeat, he knew there was something dangerous in the fireplace, and the skeletons weren't really the creature to fight. I don't know. It's as if he read the material or something. And so he had the fighter had gotten charmed. And so the cleric blocked the fighter with the shield to take any damage so that the rogue could throw a table up against the fireplace so the harpy couldn't get out. And then the wizard lit the fireplace on fire.
Wow.
So he burned the harpy up inside the fireplace. And everybody plugged their ears. And the cleric just kept the shield up against the charmed fighter. So it was a pretty amazing, like, we encountered the old school rust monster. And he loved that encounter where his sword's all rusted and everything. So he went from that, from playing it. We also went to a couple conventions. We went to the D8 Summit together and spent the whole weekend down in Illinois for the D8 Summit, and he had a wonderful time there with the great DMs and well-run convention. And so he felt he's ready to run some D&D. And so to run it, though, he wanted to make his own material. He likes to create and come up with ideas.
That's fantastic. So does Jack have like a group of friends at school that he runs games for and things like that now?
No, we haven't. We haven't really formed up any kind of a D&D group, but some children of friends of mine are who he's run online with. So he ran through the D&D Essentials adventure, and we played through the whole adventure and killed the dragon at the end, and ran that online using Fantasy Grounds.
That's terrific. So you and Jack are really close. Do you feel like this brought you closer together as father and son?
Yeah, I think it has. And Jack's got a couple of challenges in life. He has a condition called Bruton's X-linked agammaglobulinemia. They call it XLA, which is a rare immune deficiency. So he doesn't have an adaptive immune system. So vaccines don't prevent viruses from infecting him. So he has to. Ooh. He's very careful. It's kind of like boy in a bubble. Boy in a plastic bubble, if you ever saw that.
Yeah, I remember
his conditions. Maybe. Yeah, it's not quite as bad as that, but he does have, we have to be careful, things that he does and that. So he gets treatments for it. They do blood transfusion infusions every 2 weeks, and he goes through a lot. And so on top of that, he's also autistic, high functioning autistic. So we have, a couple things we cope with, but when he does, fantasy thinking or role playing or that, he just really comes into his element. So he's attracted to this type of stuff.
And that is fantastic. So even with all those challenges, Jack at a very young age has become an accomplished dungeon master and is co-authoring his own setting. That's incredible. That's something that as a father it must make you so proud.
Absolutely. And we have obviously design differences of opinions. So so those debates are pretty fun to watch once in a while to see where we're at. More than half the time he wins, he's right. So I have to say that it's nice not to have an echo chamber.
Yes.
Right. To hear this from somebody who's a younger generation. He's not really my target audience representative. He's that next generation. So I'm hoping that I'm building this for the next generation of kids that, if it makes him excited about something, then maybe that'll be for the young teen type crowd.
That is phenomenal. I love playing with my kids because they'll surprise you. They'll shock you just like that. You'll go, they look at a problem and they look at what they have available to solve that problem, sometimes in such a different way, especially when you're gamers like us who've been playing for so many years, we kind of get into a rut and into a trope and we go, okay, well, we put the fighter up front and the wizard in the middle and the thief in the back, right? And we go like that. And you get that training from all your sessions and all your sessions that when a situation calls for an imaginative, original idea. It doesn't pop out to us like it does to them.
Oh, absolutely not, right? And that's what the fascinating part of playing with kids, right? And your own kids even better, right? Because you see that and you see them pull things out that you never would have thought of it that way, right? That's amazing. And I think D&D is starting to come back at that age group too.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes it very exciting for me that kids are able to pick up 5th edition. And that's why we really coalesced on 5th edition years ago, was because of that, right? They can learn the mechanics well enough to play it. Right, there's not too much, but there's enough for those of us that have played that you're not really playing the very basic first edition type mm-hmm. stuff. So there's enough crunch, but yet kids can pick it up quick.
Yep. 14, 15 years ago, there wasn't a lot of those things available when we started gaming. I just had to kind of water down D&D and give it to them in like baby food spoon bites. You have all these options. And like you said, with 5th edition D&D, now you can get in there and they can start playing right away. You and your son have actually worked together on a new setting for 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So this particular setting, it was 1999. I wanted to create a new campaign for the players that we were playing with. And we were in a transitionary mode. We went to full Rolemaster away from, I believe, 2nd edition D&D at the time. It was right before 3rd edition came out. Okay. So we'd switched full over to Rolemaster, and I wanted to create a world that fixed some of the problems with Rolemaster. If you've ever played it, there's a number of issues with the game system, which is why it's non-existent today. It was complex in a number of areas that were problematic, but we made a world and with my campaign group, and I really wanted to contain one player. Okay, so I have a player, Andy, if you're out there, you know what you do, and always wants to go off the path, always wants to go to the next city, never wants to solve the adventure. I prepare an adventure. If he sees it too prepared, he'll just leave the dungeon. And as a DM, do you railroad somebody or do you not when you have a player, or do you kick the player out, right? Well, I like playing with Andy. He likes me being DM. I always rolled with it and, you know, created material as we went. I was able to do that, but I created all of this material. And then I realized, you know what? I'm just going to change the setting and make it a frozen world. You just don't wander off in a glacier, right? So I made up charts. If you want to, here's all the bad things that can happen to you. I made up, you know, all sorts of adventure side plots. If you want to just go walking off the glacier, here's the blizzard effects after doing research on it, right? And I'm like, okay, you can go to the next city. What next city? Which direction are you headed in the middle of its Antarctica setting is really just kind of to do it, to explain it. So you're just going to wander which direction? North? Well, every direction's north, right? So it's the South Pole, right, where you're located. So a lot of fun stuff happened with it. We developed this setting. Fast forward 20 years, we've wound down that campaign, switched from Rolemaster over. We went to Pathfinder for a few years, and then now we're looking to move everything over into 5e. But just really haven't rekindled it completely. We played a little bit in 5e, but we haven't got the group back together again with everything going on, with everybody spread all over the world and everything. Over the years, people moved. Well, my son a year ago saw all this material, binders and binders of stuff, and said, you know, he'd like to publish it. He'd like to run an event and use my setting material because he saw all these books and notes and scribbles and maps, hand-drawn, and, well, not many maps. So that would, my players would dispute I have only like one or two, but enough to be able to do it. And so he saw all these notes and said, hey, I want to run this. And so a year ago, we set about making what we had in notes into something more professional. So I had a lot of the characters drawn up, and he created new characters. I had monsters that he did research on. More than 75 of the monsters that we already have art on and all completed, he created the monsters from scratch or found them. So he has some insanely Vartucrans, plants that eat people that spit out spores. I mean, we've seen these in other systems, but he hadn't. He just created them. He said in the Arctic, again, the setting is in a South Pole, and maybe we should go into that in a minute, like more about the setting. But really how we got here was 20 years of a homebrew through multiple different systems and a 12-year-old going, hey, would like to make something of all your work.
That's amazing. It's just incredible. My 12-year-old is just now making his own modules, And I love seeing that creativeness. But for your son to just pick up your torch and say, wow, I want to help bring this to everyone, and then create so many wonderful and unique creatures and characters and things like that. And now you've put it all together. And now we're not only going to see it published, but I'm looking online and there's a Dungeon Master screen for it. There are multiple books. It's a whole set.
Yeah, we've done a lot. I've worked with miniature casting in the past, and was part of a miniature skirmish company. And so I understand the miniature part too. So we have miniatures, right? Pewter miniatures.
Wow.
We've got the DM screen. We've got the books. It's been amazing support we've had from the community to be able to get where we're at.
And the art alone, I'm a big fan of role-playing art, and the artwork so far, just what I've seen in the preview, is gorgeous, just incredible.
And thank you. And I got to interrupt and say that's sure. All the artists. I have some incredibly talented artists that I luckily stumbled into. And you guys know who you are, Philip, you know, just amazing. His work you see in the background of the cover art, you know, Alexander, Daniel, and a few other people, Bernardo, just amazing, right? They've done, you can see it. We put that out there so everybody could see what the artwork was going to look like.
You know? It's absolutely gorgeous. And most importantly, a role-playing art has to spark the imagination and not just bring illustration to the prose, but also when I look at RPG art, I need to go, wow, I can, as a game master, as a dungeon master, I can go, wow, I can make adventures with that material, and my players can actually see, oh, that's what we're looking at. That's where we're at. So Darren, could you tell us a little bit about Dalryth, the setting, and give us kind of a little bit of a preview?
Sure. So to kind of wrap it all up on what I said from earlier to come into here, the Dalryth setting was really created to contain an adventurous character, right? So it's constrictive. So think of it as a constrictive environment. The background of it was the land was once, I guess, harmony is the word I use. Forests, unicorns, elves, everybody was happy, right? A cult of evil cultists, or a group of evil cultists, summoned forth a demon from beyond, who appeared in the form of an asteroid, smashed into the ground, causing really the, in a scientific sense, the continent to shift. In a magical sense, the whole land moved, and moved the continent to the South Pole from the impact. Okay.
Wow.
Tilted the axis of the planet a little bit from a scientific standpoint, moved how the stars looked in the sky. It was such a, from a magical standpoint. So I'm writing to magic, but behind almost everything, there's a scientific background, right?
Wow.
So to make it make sense, that's because I have a science background. I've got to have everything at least in my head, even though you could just say magic does all this. Rivers can flow up water when there's magic, or uphill when there's magic. I don't usually do that unless it's rare. You make it fun, right? So basically, the continent-sized setting was originally meant to drop into any of the other game systems we were playing, because very few people touched the South Polar regions. Middle Earth didn't have it. Any of the major settings, if you think about it, where's the South Pole? What's down there? So Antarctica's always been an interest of mine. I've done research to it. I actually almost had a project putting neutrino telescopes on the South Pole, and went down there until I found out it was 18 months that I'd have to spend down there, and I gasped, and I think that hurt you in an interview. Hint to anybody interviewing, never gasp at information, right? Like, you're going to be stuck in the South Pole for 18 months. I thought it was only going to be a couple months, right? I didn't know it was going to be 18 months of freezing. I'm like, I shouldn't have gasped. But anyway, so the continent itself is down in the South Pole, which creates unique challenges, right? In the South Pole, you have 6 months of night and 6 months of day. There's not the normal day-night cycle if you have an axial tilt. If you don't have an axial tilt, then it would be 12 and 12 each day. So because we have the tilt, we have that. So the campaign really opens up with day one of spring. And now you have your half year to adventure until it gets cold again and all the bad things come out at night again.
Wow.
So that's the setting, is that you're racing against the clock. Now, we also want to spread some of the events out, because as we all know, you could level up to level 20 in 6 months of game time, right? So we have some of the events and some of the plot line. My son worked all that out. I wanted it to be more of a sandbox kind of environment where you could go do whatever. He kind of laid all the events out to kind of turn it into that plot line, which was pretty amazing work, because the way his plots work. So it's basically the first book is year one. So if you think about what we're releasing in a book, it's year one, with future books, we'll do year two and year three, which would be higher level type encounters. And with stretch goals and stuff, who knows where this may end up. Maybe we could hit enough stretch goals where we do them all as part of this project. But in any event, that's really what the setting is. So you have the unique challenges of you have now Antarctica. Now, you might say, well, how do you grow crops in Antarctica? It's frozen. Well, if you take a supervolcano like Yellowstone and you put it down on the South Pole, you now have hot spots and pockets that are ice-free.
Oh.
So the heat from volcanism and from hot springs and such keeps certain valleys within the continent arable and livable. And so, people then huddle to those spots and form cities or villages.
And so, of course, because those spots are few and far between, now you have a real conflict to control those areas.
So that Andy can't wander off and go wherever he wants to. Sorry, Andy, but no, really, from a practical standpoint, you can kind of control the storyline without having to say you can't go do that.
Wow.
Right? Or to say you have to follow the event. You really do have a sandbox, but it's a contained sandbox. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
So and it's kind of like best of both, if that makes sense.
I think every dungeon master has a challenging player at their table for different reasons. But I am most confident. My youngest, he once told me, we had a bunch of friends over. My youngest looks at me at one point, he basically tries to wreck the adventure, and I pull him to the side and I say, hey, listen, you know, it's not just you playing. What are you doing? You normally don't act like this. And he looked at me and he said, no, see, here's the problem. You've got this whole story that you're trying to unfold over there, and I'm going to wreck it. and I said, okay, all right, have a seat. Let's see what happens. And so everyone has that challenging player, and sometimes they're not always the challenging player. Just sometimes they are. And so with a setting like this, I think dungeon masters who have that player that wanders left, says, you know, hey, we have these three options. And they're like, well, I pick option number four over there. I think it's fantastic. I was looking over some of the material and I liked that there were certain houses, in the setting. And I jumped to some conclusions and I thought, well, this reminds me of a very popular TV show that also has houses. And I like that. And so I was wondering, are we going to see some political intrigue between the houses in the book?
So it's interesting. I never read that book from that TV show, which I love afterwards. I've read it and I'm like, man, I have to change stuff about my setting because this is what I was going to do and it's already been done. So when I read George R. R. Martin's stuff, I'm like, oh, shoot, we played that out. And my friends never read it. They didn't like some of the graphic nature. They read through the mm-hmm. beginning of it and didn't like it. And so we had, unfortunately, no influence, but a similar path.
Yes.
Oddly, right? So it's you got the cold there, winter's coming. It's uncannily similar. Honestly, I can say it had nothing to do with with George R. R. Martin, although he is a master of that stuff. So I do enjoy reading it. I have gone back and read it and gone, okay, I have to more so for what I have to rework, right? So I'm not a copycat than to take inspiration. But I guess you could say I'm inspired in a weird way of the same thought pattern. But yeah, so there's political intrigue. So what we had was, we're originally, I'll tell you a secret, and I don't know how much of this people have read, but there were six houses at one point. And there was something happened. Jack created this plot line, and we role played the story out and played it out. And it's pretty amazing when you get to the book and read it, what it is, the whole how this happened. But somehow the sixth house got exiled. Something happened, and they're gone. So there's five of the royal houses left. They were really descendants. Well, I guess from a timeline, when the asteroid or demon hit the land, whatever you want to call it, we don't have a timeline of how long ago that was.
Okay.
So you can't, it could be 1,000 years, it could be 1,000,000 years. Mm-hmm. It's up to the DM. We struggled with that. I spent a week trying to set a timeline out and came up with, none of it makes any sense. So just throw it out the window, because part of what we did is we evolved the races a bit. So races are different now. So you need a lot of time. From a scientific standpoint, from a magic standpoint, you could say it happened tomorrow. But from a scientific, so instead of fine-tuning how many years ago, we say it's before written history. There's no written history of how long ago that happened. Just like a lot of things about our history of the world, there's things that happened that we don't know about. So it's a prehistory. So the houses were groups of people who survived that cataclysm and then kind of stayed within the pocket of the city. And then as other survivors came in, it's a haven, and it grew. Plus, you know, they also had other creatures that just wandered in. Some of them were sentient and stayed, and some were monsters and they kill, right? Like if it's a white dragon or whatever, which I guess they're both. But in any event, that's how it goes. So there's a political intrigue. The five houses hold all the power in the town. So each of those houses then, there's a total of 11 factions, 12 if we get to that stretch goal, we'll put another one in. And that everything you do in the game impacts each of those factions. So think of it as like a meter or a score. So as you accomplish something, you might make one of the houses happy, but you might also make another one not so happy because it diminishes their power. Like in real life, right? If you became famous right now, some people would really like you no matter what you did, and somebody wouldn't. Right. The more famous you become, the more detractors you gain, but also the more fame you gain, you get the notoriety and the fame. So think of that in a granular level. And of course, if you're behind the scenes and quiet, which is what a lot of my players are, you may never gain any fame because you don't want that. Mm-hmm. Right. So you could play the game and throw the whole fame system out, or what I call it's not really fame versus notoriety. It's more like favor. So you could throw the whole favor system out and not use it as a DM. Or if your players love that political intrigue, you could be thinking of every single thing you do, how to help who you want to help. And then the next time you might help somebody else because it benefits you better. So there's a web of politics built into the setting. Or you could just say, burn the town down. I don't like anybody here, right? So there's a lot of ways you can go. That's when I call it a sandbox.
And
you can take it a lot of directions.
What I love about that is it's a post-apocalyptic setting in a frozen tundra, and different adventure paths and dungeon crawls and things like that. You can be finding things from antiquity, things in the ice, things like that. And I noticed that you put in there glacier tunnels as part of the setting. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. So if you've ever studied how glaciers move, they move a few feet every year and such. Part of what I wanted to build into this was, these are mile high glaciers on the South Pole, right? For the exceptions that aren't by the hot spots, if you tunnel into them, they actually become living tunnels and start moving. So some of these maps are particularly difficult to draw. Part of the reason why we're looking for funding is to do them right. I want the artistic look to it. I have a cartography background, but I really want an artist to do them upright so that they just sizzle, right? Because these are glacier. These aren't through rocks. These are through ice, and they would move over time. So if it's older, it might have disjointed tunnels that have moved as the glacier flows in different directions. And so there's a whole ecosystem built inside the glaciers. So you're going to have bugs in there. You're going to have critters in there. You're going to have snakes in there. You're going to have all sorts of an ecosystem, most of which are cold-resistant creatures. So it's a whole ecosystem of cold-resistance type of creatures because it's frozen, right? You're living sub-zero temperatures. So that's the fantasy element. You won't find that in Antarctica, right? You won't find creatures inside of the glaciers, but in the fantasy world, certainly. So we have, you know, the purple worms aren't purple worms here. They're the white ice worms, for example. Like you can, and you see, you know, there's giants and there's spiders, but they're ice giants or frost giants and ice spiders.
Darren, you told us so much about the Dalreth setting and so excited about it. Now, you are launching a Kickstarter. Now, when is that happening?
So we are going to launch the first book on September 22nd at 10 a.m. Central Time. So that's our first launch date.
Fantastic. And what can backers expect to see in this first book?
So we're focusing the first book on an advanced player's guide that's usable both in the setting for the future books that will be released. And then also you can use the content for your own homebrew. So it's think of it as an advanced player's guide with homebrew material, but will also contain portions of the setting as well.
And fantastic. And now, are we going to see some unique classes or some variants of maybe some traditional D&D classes?
Well, what we've been playtesting and working through is we're revamping. We're going to have our own version of a druid. So you'll see druids change fairly significantly. So I would call it a new class, not really a subclass, the way druids are handled. Less focus on wild shape and more focus on animal companions. You're going to see a ranger that, again, animal companion focused a bit and kind of making up some of the weaknesses that are inherent in the official ranger class. You're going to see wizards with more elemental based. So there'll be different wizards, really it's subclasses, but with specialties of types of magic. So you'll see a bit of that. The significant amount of spells are being added that are we're carefully playtesting and balancing. So it's not just a book of random spells. It's spells that really make sense, that fill in a lot of the gaps that are out there. And we're looking at a semi-spellcasting monk class.
Ooh.
That can cast spells.
Nice.
Kind of like a ranger, but a monk. So that'll be interesting. That's, you know, we're looking at playtesting and balancing that, right?
Okay.
To make sure it's balanced right. But a lot of the spells will be focused on mobility spells. So they can do different types of mobility or those types of actions. We're looking at revamping the monk itself to be quite a bit different in the way the monk works, with grappling being a bit different and handling those subsystems of the rules with some optional rules. If you like the way it is now, that's fine. You can use the way it is, but if you are looking for something different, that's kind of how we felt with that. And then finally, the most significant addition is a class that that I'd like to call a mentalist type class.
Now, mentalist, is that going to be like a psionic?
Yeah, in a way it's psionic, but it's not the way that D&D has ever implemented psionics.
Okay.
So think of it more of as a wizard in a way. It'll function almost identically as a wizard would, but it's mental-based spells. So a wizard draws the power from really from the outside and casts the spells and creates the magic around you. Mm-hmm. A mentalist is purely in your mind.
Okay.
So a mentalist wouldn't have spell components. It's in your mind. A mentalist could cast healing spells, for example, that are mind-based while they're unconscious.
Wow.
So they could heal themselves up while they're unconscious because their mind, as long as the mind's still alive, they can do things with their mind.
That is significant and very, very cool. I know a lot of people are going to be trying out the mentalist class and the revamp monk. So that's very awesome. So great. So September 22nd, right around the corner, Kickstarter is going to launch and we're going to jump right in. Darren, I know a lot of people are asking, is your Kickstarter going to have stretch goals?
Yes. So we're going to add more content with stretch goals. So okay. We'll have some stretch goals that are content related. So we'd like to add some more art to it. We'd like to add a few new authors in. So there's some authors we've been talking to. I'd like to be able to fund and have them write some additional things. We already have 14 new races. You're going to love some of the races that we've added to this. We have a polar bear playable race. We have a fox type race that's just amazing in design. A friend of mine's finishing writing steps on that. And a lot of the stretch goals we'll be looking at for adding some content with some new authors and new ideas to the setting. And then also we also have miniatures that we produce. So there'll be some miniature stretch goals so that if you add a new race and the miniatures aren't available and you play with miniatures, we want to be able to have those available to everybody too.
Is incredible. I can't wait. I'm a big miniatures guy. I love having those visual representations on the table. So the idea that miniatures are going to be part of the stretch goal gets me super excited. I'm going to be there on the 22nd throwing in my backing for the Kickstarter. So, and I cannot wait to bring my family to Dalrath and let them explore that amazing setting.
Well, thank you so much. And I did want to put a plug out there. We will have an early bird special. Or I call it the early dragon special. And it's a pretty amazing item. So I've shown it to you. You've seen a sneak peek.
I'm getting one because I'm going to be one of the early backers. So I hope the folks who are listening to this, we're a couple of days out from the Kickstarter. I hope they're listening to this. They're following the Kickstarter and waiting for it to launch.
Thank you.
Thank you.